and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a report from Mark Dunley on the status of the proposed project at 1011 2nd Ave in Troy. Mark talks with Jess Bennett from the local group Friends of the Mohicantuck. Then Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Elizabeth Press talks with Sean Young from the organization All of Us about a move to run far-right candidates in school board elections across the country. Later on, we talk with Plastics correspondent Alexis Goldsmith about the status of the Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR, bill. After that, Mark Dunley talks with longtime peace and justice activist Pat Hines about her new collection of articles in the book Hope, But Demand Justice. Finally, Blaze Bryant speaks with retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson, looking at weather and some of the real dangers that come along with that. But first, here are the headlines.
The murder of 10 people at a Buffalo supermarket on Saturday has focused renewed attention on what's called the replacement theory, which was highlighted by the killer as is increasingly embraced by Fox News and various Republican officials. This conspiracy theory states that welcoming immigration policies, particularly those impacting non-white immigrants, are part of a plot designed by Jews to undermine or replace the political power and culture of white people living in Western countries.
Two Republican candidates for governor on Sunday called for a return to the death penalty in New York following the mass shooting in Buffalo. The push for the death penalty by Lee Zeldin and Andrew Giuliani comes as states across the country have generally backed away from capital punishment, particularly due to the unavailability of chemicals to perform lethal injections.
The Albany Roman Catholic Diocese said Father Gregory Weider will be added for reasonable cause related to allegations of sexual abuse against minors. Announcements will be made in the many parishes where he served.
The Times Union reports that retirements across the capital region have risen. The spike in retirements is putting pressure on employers to fill more roles and train new workers. COVID has accelerated the retirement of baby boomers.
The New York Times reports that New York's courts unveiled a slate of congressional districts on Monday that would loosen Democrats' hold on key House seats and make it easier for Republicans to compete in this year's midterm elections.
The governor's top goals, post-budget, addressing affordable housing, mayoral control of schools in New York City, and passing a version of the Clean Slate Act to seal certain criminal records, have yet to be agreed to. Many other issues such as climate action and universal health care still remain unresolved. Various gun-related measures are also pending.
And following its annual spring cleanup, alternate side of street parking regulations are again being enforced in the city of Albany. The city of Troy. If you live in Troy, check into that. And that's it for the headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. If you like what you hear, tell a friend. These stories and more are available at mediasanctuary.org.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390.
Now in our first segment, indigenous groups who claim the Hudson River as part of their homelands oppose the proposed development of a parcel at 1011 2nd Avenue in Troy. Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Mark Dunley brings us the status update from Jess Bennett of the organization Friends of the Mohicantuck.
We're joined by Jess Bennett, who is the Friends of the Mohicantuck, who have been one of the groups leading the fight against the development of the 1011 2nd Avenue project in North Troy, undeveloped land on the Hudson River, sacred land of the Mohicans. And so there was a vote taking place on May 5th at the Troy City Council about whether or not to do a full environmental review. So, Jess, can you bring us up to speed? What did the City Council actually do, and and what did it mean?
Sure thing, Mark, and thanks for having me on. So on the May 5th City Council meeting, the City Council voted to end the SEQR environmental review. So SEQR stands for State Environmental Quality Review, and this is the tool that New York State has to look at every aspect of a potential project. So not just what's growing, but the effect of the potential pollution, how it affects the neighbors, the surrounding area, any potential history, really all possible aspects that a project may have, SEQR looks at. And so the City Council voted 6-1 to end the environmental review. Keani Connolly Wilson of District 5 was the only council member who voted against ending it. Surely the clear cutting of the last undeveloped forest on the Hudson deserves some more environmental inquiry. And unfortunately, the City Council did not see it like that.
Now, you know, sometimes when a decision like this is made, you know, not to do in full environmental review, there's a possibility of litigation. Is that something the groups are thinking about at this point, or I understand is, you know, now moves forward to a May 25th hearing on the actual rezoning of the land? So what's sort of the plan of action at this point to respond to what the city did?
You're absolutely right. So the next thing that comes up is a hearing for the rezone. The area and the neighborhood that 1011 Second Avenue sits in is a very quiet, single family residential neighborhood. So certainly the addition of 230 apartments in three high density four story buildings would be a huge change to the character of the neighborhood. So on May 25th, the City Council is holding a public hearing we really wanna see and encourage as many folks, residents, Trojans to come out because this will really set precedents for other areas and other projects. You know, we have zoning. Zoning has many purposes, and some of them are not so great and holdovers from things like redlining. But at the end of the day, right now, zoning is keeping us from having, say, a Target open up right in your backyard. And it helps to ensure the character of a neighborhood. And right now, the developer, Kevin Vandenberg, is applying for a change to a P plan development, which really doesn't even encompass the scope of this project. Within a P plan development zoning district, there is a maximum of 8 units per acre. This is a 10-acre forest they'll be cutting down. So that's 80 units. So on top of this zoning change, they then need to apply for a 150-unit variance. We do not think that this zoning change should be granted by the City Council.
Now, I used to serve a long time ago on my local town board. And, you know, I sort of remember from back then that this type of zoning change was not something that was really viewed as being particularly legal, that you're not supposed to do spot zoning for a particular project. And the underlying zoning maps is supposed to reflect, you know, sort of a long-term comprehensive plan, you know, for the city. And you're not supposed to be rezoning because the developer wants to do something. So how are they moving forward with this particular project, which seems to be a pretty significant rezoning of one particular property?
You make a lot of great points there, and we absolutely cannot be allowing spot rezoning, as that is not, I believe, legal in New York State. And even more importantly, the City of Troy, the residents, our planning department spent a lot of money and time putting together the comprehensive plan, which was only issued in 2018. So it's a still very relevant document, and this development and rezone is absolutely not consistent with the comprehensive plan. This area up here is identified for green space, which it currently is, and it is not identified in the comprehensive plan as having a high density apartment complex. It's very out of place, a development like this. And, you know, once again, we really want the residents to come out, because next this could be happening in your neighborhood. And zoning is here to help ensure the quality of our chosen neighborhoods and the characteristics. And, you know, I've spoken to every single neighbor in the neighborhood up here, and every one of them is unanimously against this development. So,
you mentioned earlier when they were, you know, considering whether or not to do a full environmental review, which they rejected, that one of the criteria that you mentioned was the issue of history. And my understanding, this has some historical significance in terms of the Mohican, you know, people, the original indigenous, you know, inhabitants of this area. Was that not something that the city took into consideration?
It's really disappointing, Mark. In the environmental assessment form, which is the kind of criteria in SEAKER that they need to use to evaluate a potential project, the archaeology of this site, which it is a National Register eligible Indigenous archaeological site that has been used for about 10,000 years. We have archaeology reports that have artifacts from this very site that date back to 3000 BC. But even in the present, there are several tribes that have hereditary ties to this land that are also currently petitioning the Troy government to protect this land and keep it from being developed, like the Scaticoke First Nations and the Stockbridge Munsee. So in the hearings on the SEAKER for this, what they looked at, they definitely recognized this is a very important site. But when it came to the project, what they said was there will be future mitigation techniques. And I'm sorry, future mitigation is not a plan that protects our cultural assets here in Troy. It was a really disappointing vote. And I had really hoped that given the outpouring of overwhelming support for a positive declaration, which just means there are more things that need to be studied, of which the council identified a number of criteria that satisfied a positive declaration, really thought they would have voted that way. So it's, unfortunately, it's disappointing, and it doesn't seem like they're taking a lot of steps to protect this cultural asset.
So we have about 2 minutes left. I'll do sort of a two-part question. So there's a May 25th hearing on the rezoning, and I believe the public can attend and hopefully even testify. And then I heard you thought they probably will vote on it in June. Once a rezoning is done, are there other steps that will need to be taken before the project can actually be launched? And if people want to get involved to find out more information, how best they can do that in 90 seconds.
So what's lucky about this entire process is there's no one decision where a project gets stamped approved. After the rezone, if it were to move forward, the developer would then need to apply for permits. And there's a host of different permitting agencies across the state, from like the DEC or the State Historic Preservation Offices, that all would need to go through their own permitting process. So this is still a long road, but it's so important that the residents of Troy, and really anybody, but in this case, the city does want to hear from residents, come out to speak at the rezone hearing on May 25th at 6 p.m. at City Hall, which is 433 River Street. And if anybody wants to get more information, our website is save1011.org, and we're on social media at Friends of the Mohican Tuck on Facebook and Instagram.
Well, thank you very much. This has been Jess Bennett, Friends of the Mohican Tuck. We've been talking about the ongoing struggle to protect 1011 Second Avenue in North Troy, Lansingburg area. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We have been following this story and will continue to follow the potential development of 1011 Second Ave in Troy. We also spoke with the Indigenous visitors to the fish market last week. Those segments will be coming out. You can find those and stay tuned, mediasanctuary.org.
And Tuesday, May 17th, is election day for school boards and school budgets throughout New York. Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Elizabeth Press talks with Sean Young about a national conservative campaign to elect far-right members in local school board elections.
Take Back Our School Boards has endorsed conservative candidates across the country. Here to help us understand more about this group, Take Back Our School Boards, and the impact on the campaigns, especially here locally, is Sean Young from All of Us Community Action Group. So from your understanding, what is or what drives this national group, Take Back Our School Boards?
I feel like what's driving them is that is the changes that have happened over the course of several years in our community. This level of awareness around social justice and racial justice issues have increased. There are more and more people that are on board with the understanding that these changes actually need to happen, that equity is the thing that needs to come to our community, that we need to be teaching our children an honest history of this country and where we've been in order for us to understand like where we're going as a society. These folks that are part of these different groups are against that. They don't want change. They want power to, in my opinion, stay in certain pockets of this community. They don't value the entire community in a way that would reflect in some of their political rhetoric. They're interested more in ignoring our actual history and continuing to walk with blinders. And that doesn't make a lot of sense for so many of us in our community. And they operate from a place of fear, that to change things is scary and that you should fear that change and not welcome it.
Thank you for that. So school board elections are on Tuesday, May 17th.
Yes.
Groups like Take Back Our School Boards are supporting candidates here in the Capital Region. What should people know going in and voting on Tuesday, and sort of like what is their campaign locally?
You have a slate of candidates that are deniers of actual history, that they don't want to hear about critical race theory, which is really just basically a retelling of the actual history of addressing the many omissions that you and I, as growing up in public school, that happened with us, and just trying to basically just understand that so that we don't repeat those mistakes and then help us move forward. And you also have candidates that, you know, that are denying data around having police in schools and what that impact has on Black and Brown students. Listen, we have a more and more diverse community, right? Every generation, our communities are getting more and more diverse. There are those folks that will, in so many different ways, are attempting to deny those populations the right to their own history and then the right to determine what they want for their kids in schools and the right to, I believe, to a fullness of this society. Look at who the conservatives are endorsing. You have conservatives like Liz Joy, right-wing folks. You have conservatives like Rudy Giuliani, who are swooping down from a national platform to endorse candidates to actually take over our education system. That's a scary thing. We have enough problems as it is. Now you have conservative right-wings trying to tell us, like, no, we can't teach our kids this stuff, and we need to roll back the progress that we made. We don't want to do that. So those candidates are clear. In the city of Schenectady, you have folks that are running, and I would say take a close look at who's endorsing them and who's not. I would say that it's really problematic with the endorsements of the right-wing folks for two of those candidates.
And Sean, how do parents who are more progressive-leaning participate as parents through the mechanisms of like school boards?
One of the first steps is just understanding the actual history, right? And getting involved as much as possible and showing up at the school board and having your voice heard on these issues, listening in on some of the policies and some of the policies that are coming out of the school board, paying close attention to what's going on at your particular school with the principal on down and what your child is being taught. It's important to do all of that. And it's also important to partner with other parents. Right. In your community, one of the things that becomes really, really problematic in our communities is that we don't talk to each other enough. It's about reaching out and having those conversations. The concerns you have, I'm sure, are shared by other people. And opening that door to communication could mean the world of difference in finding other support networks and other ways of thinking and talking about the issue that you have concern, other ways to addressing them. So you have this community aspect where I'm talking to my neighbors, I'm talking to other family members that have children at the school, right? And I'm talking to the folks at the school itself, and I'm showing up at the board meetings, because that's where you can actually speak to the administrative staff. You can have your issues heard by them and the board. The superintendent and his staff shows up at every board meeting. You can have your voice heard. There was a process of like being able to write in, sending emails, and problematic thing there. Kathy Lewis, the president of the board, recently has quelled that, like stopped that process, which is what I believe was a longstanding process of hearing from the community through email of those that couldn't show up. And what I believe was to silence a lot of the voices that were against some of the policies that they were that some on the board were for. And that's a problematic way of proceeding in anything. It's a democratic process. We want to hear from the voices of the community. And if you want to, if you're trying to get involved, I believe those are the steps you could take. It's not always easy getting up and talking, right, on a microphone. And maybe it's easier for talking to the family of your children's friends. But maybe it's easier to do that than to get on a microphone. Maybe it's easier to send an email. Maybe it's easier just to talk within your neighborhood, but action steps have to happen because policy changes are going on. And if you want your voice heard, you have to step up in some way.
This group, this national campaign supported by Liz Joy and Rudy Giuliani, is everywhere. Take back our school boards. It's not just here in the Capital Region. Are there any nationally grounded movements that counteract these conservative groups? Or like, what strategies should we be thinking of tactically to challenge this well-funded movement?
Wow, that's a huge question. And I am unaware of any large national groups, and that's a problem in and of itself, because this is happening and from the right wing advocacy point. Where are the other points of view and perspectives? Where's the money being spent to ensure that these things aren't happening? Right now, it feels really like a local. We're fighting this national thing locally, and that's scary as hell. I know NYCLU has at least written some letters about, you know, reasons why some of the policies of like having police in schools is problematic, and there's all the data that supports that. But we haven't seen like a national push to be like, wait a minute, we can't do this. And you think about the idea of naming your group Take Back Our School Boards, they're trying to take our education. They're trying to take our education system and turn it on its head and for it so that it fits a particular agenda, right? An agenda that leaves out many, right? That doesn't address the history of slavery, the history of oppression, and the issues of all the... It's almost like we would rather glorify our history and deny all the other truths and to keep walking in our future with blindfolds on. And it doesn't make any sense. I call on any national group that is against this right-wing agenda to step up to the plate. There's 30 states in this country that have Republican majority or conservative majorities right now. These things are going to be happening time and time again. How we educate our children is extremely important to what kind of society we have. And if we allow this to happen on this level, where else will it go? I call on the voters, I call on the families in the community that want to see their children get a full understanding of the history of this country. They want to be safe. They want to be well. They want to be in community with other cultures and other people that are different. I call on them to come out, vote, get involved, get engaged. It's about the future of our children.
Sean Young, thank you so much for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you want to make sure that you fit in?
Like, whether you have children in school or you don't have children in school, what happens in that school building, how our children are educated, determines how our society will be run in future generations. If we have differences of opinion about how we move forward, fine. We work through that through a democratic process, through a community process, and we're not going to agree on all things. But some of the stuff that are coming from the right wing is dangerous, in my opinion, and very scary. And I would say that it's worthy of your time, your concern, your care to show up at the voting booth, to show up in conversations with your family in the neighborhood, and to show up talking with family members at the school itself. I hope that you do. Either way, you don't do something, you do something, it's going to have an impact. No one's on the sidelines in this.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Elizabeth Press talking with Sean Young from the group All of Us. Very conservative candidates are running in many local elections, including Bethlehem, Guilderland, Schenectady, North Colony, South Colony, Voorheesville, and other localities. Voting in local elections is an important democratic right, and local newspapers will have information on candidates. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bzilahicki.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we are joined by our regular plastics correspondent, Alexis Goldsmith, for a discussion of the Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR, bill. Welcome, Alexis. Perhaps you can start us off with an overview of what extended producer responsibility means and why you think this bill is important.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. So, extended producer responsibility is a law that holds producers accountable for the waste that they generate on the products that they put into the marketplace. So, producer is consumer brands like Coke, Nestle, Pepsi, all those brand Kellogg's that put products into the marketplace. And there are many different types of extended producer responsibility. There are bills for carpets, mattresses, paints. In New York, we have one on batteries. But the one that I'm here to talk about today is an extended producer responsibility law for packaging. And it's meant to make producers pay for the cost to collect and either landfill, recycle, or incinerate the waste from their packaging.
So when you say packaging, what does that include? The bottles themselves, but anything else?
Yeah, so any good that you buy at the store that comes in packaging would fall under this law. So the bulk of our packaging is probably groceries, but also hardware, any consumer good. And it includes e-commerce as well. So when you order something online, the box or the plastic mailer or the plastic bubble wrap that it comes in, that is also considered packaging under this law. Or this bill, rather.
So this is an average of 6.8 million tons of packaging. So all of this is just the consumer's packaging is 40% of the waste that is produced. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think the number is closer to half of the waste stream is from municipal waste. A lot of that packaging ends up in municipal waste, but there's also a lot of waste that's in the supply chain for products because they have to be extracted, manufactured, and transported and distributed. And that accounts for half of the waste that ends up in landfills or incinerators. So this bill covers packaging waste, but it's not just municipal waste.
Wow, that's a lot. And this is just the plastic packaging, that's a question. Products are being wrapped in like corn plastic or all these alternative sealants that look like plastic. But I wonder, one, are they at all better? And is this number only looking at plastic waste?
Mm-hmm. So this bill, which by the way, the bill numbers are Assembly Bill 10185, sponsored by a New York State Assemblyperson Engelbright. This bill covers all types of packaging, which can be made from many different types of materials like plastic, paper, cardboard, aluminum, and glass are the most common ones. and also mixed packaging. So packaging that has different types of materials in it, for example, a cardboard, but it has plastic film, something like that. So this bill is aimed at reducing all of those, but a big problem with packaging is that most of it today is made from single-use plastics. And in fact, nearly half of all plastic produced in the world today is for single use. So this is contributing to litter, not just litter that winds up in our rivers and in our oceans and our food systems, but it takes up landfill space, and it's also burned in incinerators, which contributes to air pollution. And plastic, of course, is made from fossil fuels, which contribute to climate change during the manufacturing process. So yes, plastics are a big deal when it comes to packaging.
I'm going to take advantage of having you here, because today I worked a food distribution event where pallets and pallets of food were all wrapped in thin, clear plastic wrap. I gathered that to recycle, but there were also a lot of very darkly colored thin film plastics surrounding the little packs of six bottles and things. Mm-hmm. Can dark thin film also be recycled, or only the clear?
So thin film is actually not recycled at a rate that makes a difference. Less than 4% in the United States. And plastic grocery bags, before they were banned in the state, were a big culprit. But also Amazon, the thin plastic envelopes that Amazon ships packages in that say return to store collection site for recycling, that's a scam. It's really just to distract and make consumers feel like they're doing the right thing by taking their plastic back to the store, but it doesn't ultimately get recycled.
What I understand is they do have the recycling symbol, and even though it is, you know, more to like convince us that it's not so bad, there could be a facility that could recycle that, but generally those don't exist. So therefore, they're able to say that it's recyclable, except really, I know when I was living in New York City, they have a pretty restrictive recycling. Only very few numbers are recyclable. And so it really often depends on what your local facility is able to take, right? Which is generally not those everyday objects.
Yes, absolutely. But the definition of recyclable is starting to change. California last year passed a suite of plastic reduction bills, and one of them was the Truth in Labeling bill, which, getting away from our EPR bill for just a second, this bill requires that you cannot put the chasing arrow symbol on a package unless you can prove that you can achieve 60% recycling of that material. So in the US, plastics are recycled at a rate of less than 6%. So most plastic packaging will not be able to bear the chasing arrow symbol in California anymore. But getting back to the EPR bill, A10185 in the New York State Assembly right now, this sets reduction requirements for packaging, which is the first and most important step. So it sets a 50% reduction requirement over the first 10 years. So all of the packaging in grocery stores, at Walmart, at the hardware store, all of that has to be halved within 10 years. And then after 10 years, the remaining packaging has to be 90% either recyclable, and it is actually getting recycled, or made from recycled content, 90% of that remaining packaging. So in the end, a very small amount of packaging is getting disposed of, landfilled or incinerated, if we pass this bill and make it into law.
You went into a few of those points there. It also looks at toxic substances, or actually I'll leave it to you. Could you go over some of the other points in that bill?
Yes, toxic substances, the way this bill handles it, sets this bill as a leader in the United States. This is the strongest extended producer responsibility law for packaging ever introduced in the United States. So Oregon and Maine already have EPR for packaging because it addresses toxics. So plastic in particular, when it's manufactured, has thousands of chemicals added to it, flame retardants to keep it from catching on fire because it's made from petrochemicals, but also dyes and plasticizers. And these are toxic. They are endocrine disruptors. They can affect children's development and they can cause cancer. So this EPR bill requires the most common toxics to be eliminated from packaging, which is really important because a lot of our food comes in packaging and that's how you're exposed. But also because getting toxics out of packaging is important for recycling, because when it comes to recycling, a lot of materials that get recycled are turned into something that was never their original intended use. And there's no chain of custody for those toxics. So you don't know what's in your recycled materials, all the more reason to get toxics out of packaging.
And there's certainly an environmental justice issue here because the communities that are impacted by plastic production are usually in lower income areas. And I'm getting the signal that we are out of time. So thank you, Alexis.
But we do want to hear about there's an event happening.
Oh, yes. So Beyond Plastics is hosting an event tomorrow night on this bill so that people can learn about it.
Tomorrow, which is Tuesday.
Tuesday, sorry. Yes, Tuesday, May 17th at 7 p.m. It's an online teach-in with Assemblymember Englebright, and it's on Zoom. So go to our website, beyondplastics.org/events. And I do want to mention the environmental justice aspect, because it's not just environmental justice, but it's environmental racism. So where these plastic facilities are built and where they're polluting is in Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities across the United States. And that's by design. So EPR is important for addressing the justice aspect of packaging, which many people are probably not even, how would you know unless you knew?
Great. Thank you so much, Alexis Goldsmith. So we'll have the link to that information session for Tuesday, May 17th in the description to this recording. And that's a place to ask all these questions about like how this bill would work. And because, I mean, I'm leaving this conversation with a lot of questions. So that's the place to go, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and now longtime peace and justice activist Pat Hines recently released a book, Hope But Demand Justice, a collection of articles on topics related to the environment, peace themes, justice efforts, and more. Mark Dunley talks with her now about the book and her work.
We're joined today by Pat Hines, former director of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice and also retired professor on environmental health at Boston University. She's been a frequent guest on our peace segments, but she's written a new book, maybe say a collection of articles between 2010 and 2021. Is called Hope But Demand Justice. So Pat, what motivated you to pull this collection of your articles together?
Well, I was first asked to by the publisher Haley's. It was not originally my intention, but I do have a column in our local regional newspaper and also have been writing opinion pieces on all of the issues that concern us, nuclear power and weapons, climate, biodiversity, COVID-19, militarism, veterans, possibilities of peace, international collaborations, and the pursuit of sexual, racial, and economic justice. So her suggestion was that I pull these articles together on these various topics and that their publisher would publish the book called Hope But Demand Justice.
Well, when you went through, a dozen years or so of write-ins and had the opportunity to look back over time and see what you're writing about, what were priorities, What sort of struck you about how things had changed or remained the same over that period of time?
Well, of course, there were some new issues like the COVID-19. However, in terms of militarism, it's been a persistent theme. And if anything, almost worse today, I would say, if you want to gauge it by the budget, this is the largest U.S. military budget in history. We are throwing money through weapons into the war in Ukraine and ignoring problems at home. I think the thing that has truly measurably worsened is, of course, the climate crisis. And I have to say that the IPCC, International on Climate Change, report that came out in February, a few days before this war in Ukraine began, has been ignored totally by the press. And I will just use one line from it, which is, we have 3 years as a world, 2025, to bring our emissions down, or the fate of the world is sealed in terms of increasing crises.
Since we have you on, obviously much of the world, at least the Western world, is focused right now on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, certainly I think the peace movements have been very outspoken, even though the United States had a role in sort of, you know, prompting Russia to invade, that, you know, mm-hmm. worldwide combination of the invasion, no excuse. But at the same time, I get really worried about the amount of relatively liberal people who are sort of share leading to send in more weapons to Ukraine. What has been sort of your response to how the media and in general, how we've responded to the situation in the Ukraine?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think that the response on the part of the people is very similar to the response on the part of the government. Biden, I mean, whether it was a gaffe or not, basically said quite recently that he wants to see Putin destroyed. He wants to see Russia weakened and Putin destroyed. And our head of DOD Pentagon, General Austin, when he went to visit recently, said, our goal is to see Russia weakened. And Nancy Pelosi said something to that effect as well. I feel that this war is really a geopolitical war, that our country, through its weapons, is actually carrying out with Russia. And the other thing I want to say in terms of how this is all going to end, I read opinion piece by Jeffrey Sachs that I thought was most effective. And essentially, his conclusions were that that we are prolonging through sending weapons, and NATO as well, is ultimately, it may weaken Russia, it won't defeat it, but it will absolutely destroy the Ukraine. So that the more weapons we send, the more we are sustaining a war that is destroying a country.
Now, reading a little bit of your background, one of the points you make that you you say you were fortunate to come of age during, you know, four of the most important social movements of the 20th mm-hmm. century. You know, what were they, and mm-hmm. you know, how do they, you know, come together and impact upon, you know, your perception or your life's work?
Yes, they have absolutely influenced everything, every choice that I've made for work, and also the 10 years of writing. And I was fortunate, like anyone of my generation, to come of age in the mid to late 1960s through the early 70s. And there were four of the most significant historical movements in our country that happened. And they too came of age during that period. The first was the civil rights movement. And that movement really impelled me to teach African-American children in inner city schools. And the lessons that I learned, my eyes were open. The lessons I learned from them have followed me the rest of my life. The Vietnam War, simultaneously, and so vilified by Martin Luther King in his famous Materialism, Militarism, and Racism, that clarified my conviction, as it did for so many in this country, that war is not the answer. And I love this line from John Milton to use it, including for this current war. What does war but endless war still breed? And that's exactly what is happening with this war, with NATO, the US, the engagement, weapons to Ukraine, etc. The women's movement of the late 60s and early 70s was deeply, deeply influential on me. And I've carried it with me throughout my life, using, living what I've learned, standing up to authority in places where I thought they were making wrong decisions, etc., inequity in pay. But it was most recently a book called Sex and World Peace by a group of researchers that brought together for me, I think most intimately, the principles of feminism, the belief in it as a movement to change the world with respect to even to peace and to war. And essentially the finding, key finding of this group of researchers was that the degree of a statistical finding, I will add, the degree of women's equality is the most important factor for the relative peacefulness or degree of conflict in every society and country, more important than the degree of democracy, than religion, et cetera. And another thing that they and others have pointed out, that studies have shown that women are critical in areas of conflict to peacemaking. Further, that, and I will add, and this stays with me as it does with so many, violence against women is the most underreported crime in the world. And it actually, it gets much worse during periods of conflict and during war. That is rape, that is sex for food, that is demanded, et cetera. And finally, the environmental movement, which was also came alive in that same period of time. And ultimately, it led me to go to graduate school in environmental engineering to work for the EPA Superfund program, and ultimately at Boston University as a professor there to work with teams of poor people and agencies, in state agencies, city agencies, in public housing to address the problem of lead poisoning, of asthma, of use of pesticides to get rid of rodents who were causing, or rather I should say triggering asthma, et cetera, and also to do a book on community gardens in inner cities throughout the country, and to see community gardens in inner cities as extremely important to address food scarcity, but also to the lack of beauty and nature in cities. So all of these movements, like so, as with so many of my generation, were deeply influential. And for me, they came together as opposed to what we talked about earlier, single issue movements. They're all interrelated, like the web of life is.
I'm talking with Pat Hines, Hope But Demand Justice, former director of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice, and is published by Haley's Press. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
To hear more from Pat Hines, Mark recently interviewed her about her recent op-ed about why peace activists and others are joining in on the Poor People's Campaign March on Washington in June. That and other related segments can be found on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
And for our final segment, Blaze Bryant continues to take a break from co-hosting, but does bring us this discussion with retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson. This time, they focus again on thunder and thunderstorms, something quite timely given the weather and sound effects on Monday evening as we're producing this program.
Retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson joining me, Blaze Bryant, on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Hey, Hugh, hope you had a good week.
I did. The weather could have been much better.
I agree. Well, you did say last week it was going to be one of the best weather weeks of the year. And well, as you have proven to be, not wrong.
Thank you. Well, not 100%, but yeah, I did pretty good last week. Not quite as good yesterday with the storm.
Yeah, I mean, what happened yesterday? Because as we were figuring things out and sending emails back and forth and whatnot, you said that this storm came out of nowhere.
Yeah, kind of. It actually did come out of somewhere, but here's what happened. Well, you know, basically, it just goes to show you that this is my boss once summed it up. Meteorology is a humbling, forecasting is a humbling business. And indeed, yesterday was one of those examples. It looked like a benign system to the west. I went to a picnic, and I, the only smart thing I did not bike to it, but there was a shower that went through. I said everyone's going to clear out, and then we're going to have 2 hours of you know, calm weather. Well, that didn't happen because all of a sudden, the thing started laying down outflow boundaries and all kinds of storms started developing around it. And then the other line started to accelerate, and the two kind of met and formed a pretty nasty thunderstorm. It wasn't severe, at least where I was, but boy, it rained hard, lightning. And I tried to get home, and I thought I had 10 minutes to get home. I had less than five. And so I had a core punch at the end. So, you know, it is a humbling business, because every single mesoscale model showed that the thing would not come in until 2 hours later. Every single one, I looked at every single one of them, Blaze. So, but you know, sometimes weather has a mind of its own. It just does.
So even with all the technology and whatnot, because, I mean, as you know, Hugh, meteorologists are kind of like managers or coaches in sports, and they get, you know, a lot of criticism when things don't pan out properly.
That is true. And the difference with perhaps today, we have a more organized system coming through. It's usually more predictable. Yesterday was it was a weaker system, but it still produced its own little mesoscale stuff that even the mesoscale models can pick up on.
Gotcha. Hugh Johnson with me, Blaze Bryant, here on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Some absolutely unfortunate disasters, Hugh, that we've got to talk about as a relation to climate change with the wildfires and other stuff in India.
Yes. Well, let's talk about India first, because, okay, so India, they have basically two seasons, a dry season and a wet season that's usually induced by a monsoon, which really just means a shift in wind. It doesn't necessarily guarantee rain, but often does. But right now, what's happening is, you know, you get this big high that builds off the Tibetan, the plain off the Himalayas and builds into India. And it's usually very dry until about now, but it has been excessively hot. I mean, they've been hitting 122 degrees day after day. And places Jeez. Like Calcutta and New Delhi, you know, close to that, and nighttime lows in the 80s. It's been humid, too. It's not just a dry heat. There's just been some humidity involved, and it's killing people. I mean, the heat-related death is one of the hard things to determine exactly, because, yeah, a heat stroke is obvious. It was from the heat, but there's a marked increase in heart attacks during heat waves and right after them, too. So, and a lot of people say that's the number one killer of all weather events. You heard that correct. Higher than tornadoes, hurricanes, and floods combined is heat death. In Europe in 2003, there was like anywhere up to 500,000 deaths because they had a horrible heat wave that summer. India is a little more prepared for it if you're in the middle upper class. In the lower class, forget it. You're screwed because you're not getting cooling at night. And this is, there's no break in this. This is relentless. And, you know, what they got to hope for is the monsoon season. The shift in the wind will come off the Bay of Bengal, and it will not necessarily get, will certainly not get less humid, but it will get less hot, and they'll have showers and they could have heavy rain, and that will cool them down to the 80s at least, not the 100s. So very, very bad situation. They said it's already been at least 25 heat-related deaths. I guarantee you multiply that by 100. There's been probably thousands of heat deaths from this.
Wow.
So that's India. Now back to the Southwest. They too have a monsoon season. People won't realize there's a monsoon in like Arizona, New Mexico that happens in July. Last year, Tucson got 10 inches of rain in July, but right now they can't buy a raindrop. They're bone dry. They're going to be 100 degrees or close to it day after day. And it's just been so dry that there's already been fires there and in California that were set something possibly by arsonists. And, you know, it's just the beginning of the fire season, but they've already had wildfires out there for the past month. My sister and her husband were traveling through New Mexico and Arizona, and they were getting blown away on their RV by high winds, and they could see the fires everywhere. It's really a bad situation. It's going to get worse. It's just all there is to it, as long as climate change is left unchecked.
That's for sure. So, I'm absolutely fascinated by the fact that heat stroke, let's just say it for what it is, heat stroke is the biggest killer in terms of weather causes.
Heat-related death. Heat stroke's part of it, but there's also the heart attacks and other stresses that body can cause death. But heat stroke is definitely part of it. I mean, heat stroke is a no-brainer. I mean, your temperature rises over 104. You're basically like an overheated engine. You're just out there dying.
Right. I mean, this just occurred to me, Hugh, and I know that's not in our topic list here, but talk about the impacts that you're concerned about now, knowing that the ban on burning was lifted as of over the weekend.
Yeah, that ban on burning thing, that's a political. I was the fire weather focal point at National Weather Service Albany, and I know all about that. It's a political. Generally speaking, we probably have reached green up. And it has, I think we have reached. If you look around, the trees are mostly out now, the grass is growing. So mm-hmm. I'm not as concerned now, because what happened was we saw a regime change on Thursday, I think. The dew points climbed from the 30s to 50s, and now it's been the 60s. So I think our threat of any fires are minimal. We've had, of course, the rain. I had 7,900 from that storm yesterday, the kind of surprise storm. And we're going to get more rain, more rain involved, and it might be a little more later in the week. So I think the fire weather threat, whatever it was, is not really a threat anymore, because once we're greened up, that is really a things that the fire behavior is a lot different. And as long as we stay greened up, I mean, very rare we get a drought around here in the summer. You know that, at least recently. So I think we're fine with that.
Okay. I just, one of those things that just popped into my head, and I figured, hey, why not ask you about it?
Absolutely.
So a couple of minutes left here, Hugh. What's the weather looking like for the week?
Well, this week's going to be a little different from last week. It's not going to be terrible, but it's more active. We're back to that Rex block we talked about. It's completely broken down. It was crappy down south of us during much of the week, but that's all changed now. We're going to start seeing systems coming through. We got the big one today. It's going to cool down on Tuesday. It's going to feel almost like autumn again, because it's going to be a brisk wind and temperatures in the 60s and 50s. So you'll have to bring your jackets out. Wednesday looks good. Thursday, a little disturbance brings perhaps a few showers early. And then it looks like a great day Friday. And Saturday, it's going to heat up way up in the 80s again. But it looks like it's only a one-day thing now, because another big front's going to come through with the high pressure from Canada. And hopefully it'll come through smoothly. So we'll have just a few hours of showers, and then we'll get back to nice and cooler weather. So it's a more active week this week than last week. It's not going to be we're stuck under a big high pressure like we were last week.
Well, that is, that's music to my ears, which I certainly appreciate, because the high pressure just, yeah, it's not a fun thing. So any final thoughts here before we go our separate ways here for the week?
Well, we are getting severe thunderstorms. I mean, we're in the thunderstorm season. Maybe we'll talk about tornadoes, because we're getting into not that we get a real tornado season, but May, it can ramp up the threat of tornadoes. So maybe we'll talk about that next time and that kind of thing. And we're in the summer now, but we still get the big temperature changes, but not like we did in April and March.
Sure. All right, Hugh, sounds good. We will leave it there. Hugh Johnson, retired meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Thank you so much.
All right, Blaise. Have a great day.
Those are good reminders of the real dangers that weather brings, and of course, disproportionately affects low-income demographics. That was our check-in, weekly check-in with Hugh Johnson, Blaise's check-in with Hugh Johnson. Thank you for that reporting.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, co-host and engineer. Our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
And to hear local news and art stories, tune in every weekday at 6 p.m. for our live show, rebroadcast the following weekday at 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. Or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.